Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us once again today Mr. Michael Flannery, author of the recent book, Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism. Michael Flannery is professor and associate director for historical collections at the Lister Hill Library of Health Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He has a background in both library science and history, holding two master's degrees, and he is also an accomplished writer. In 2001, he won the prestigious Edward Kramer's Award for Distinguished Writing by an American from the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. Earlier this year, he published a piece in Forbes magazine online titled Alfred Russel Wallace, and that actually brings us to the title of his seventh book, which we're talking about today. It's Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism, published by Erasmus Press. And if I understand correctly, Mr. Flannery, you can pick it up on Amazon.com. Is that right?
Yes, you can.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming back for part two with us today in this podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, in part one, we started off talking about your book, Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution. And I want to say first off that I found your book to be an incredibly enjoyable read. Not only does it have a very lucid historical introduction that places Darwin and Wallace in their appropriate historical context and discussing the differences between their views, but this was actually a surprise to me. I did not realize that the second half of the book, or the second section of the book, is actually an edited version of a book that was written by Alfred Russel Wallace that is titled The World of Life. And it's a fascinating introduction to the views of Alfred Russel Wallace, which really, in my read of it, refute any notion that Alfred Russel Wallace was not a progenitor of intelligent design type thinking. And so I want to talk about that a little bit more. We'll probably get into that a little bit in this podcast, but let's first pick up where we left off in the last podcast, talking about Wallace's position relative to Darwin. So I want to talk about a book that you talk about in your book, and that is Michael Shermer's book, which is titled In Darwin's Shadow, which happens to be about Alfred Russel Wallace. And you can guess from the title how it postures Wallace. So why have some people like Shermer tried to put Wallace in Darwin's shadow?
I guess the most obvious answer to that is that Wallace presents a real problem for people who want to deny anything like intelligent design in nature. So Wallace, who came to really argue extensively for a form of ID in nature, cannot be left to stand alone. He must somehow be recast either in Darwin's image or, as Shermer so aptly puts it, unwittingly, I think so, but as he puts it, in Darwin's shadow. Now, what I think is happening here is that the defenders of Darwinian evolution are trying to do something that I've noticed that they repeatedly do, and that's conflate ID with creationism. That way they can sort of replay this sort of inherit the wind scenario and portray themselves as defenders of science against rural backwater country rubes, which is really how Hollywood falsely portrayed the so-called Scopes monkey trial of the 1920s. And they can portray themselves in this sense as the defenders of science against those who want to stop science in the classroom. In other words, the progressive forces of learning and education against the reactionary forces of ignorance and repression. So you see, with Wallace, they're faced with a real problem, because with Wallace, they're faced in one individual, someone who is non-Christian, non-creationist, a thorough evolutionist, who not only independently discovered natural selection, but came to a view of nature imbued with intelligent design. So an unamended Wallace would really force the Darwinists to admit three important things. First, it's absolutely possible to believe in evolution without subscribing to Darwinism. And this is something which we can get into later that I call intelligent evolution. Second, ID is not, nor was it from the beginning, creationist. And third, ID was derived from scientific observations more than 100 years ago, drawn by Alfred Russel Wallace. frankly, we see it here as early as Wallace's famous Ternate letter of 1858, the letter that he sent to Darwin actually laying out his theory of natural selection. So all this to say that those who write about Wallace but really don't want to relinquish the materialistic implications of Darwinian evolution have it in their own interest to cast Wallace in Darwin's shadow.
Mr. Flannery, I think you just hit on, for me, one of the most important points that I took from your book, and you put it very well, that when you read this book, you just cannot deny the fact that it is very possible to be involved with intelligent design type thinking without getting involved with creationist type thinking. And I think that Alfred Russel Wallace was actually very sensitive to this. And if we can jump ahead a little bit into his world of life, it seems like Alfred Russel Wallace was actually up against some of the same kind of opposition that many modern ID proponents face, namely that he was being attacked as allegedly promoting special creation. And on page 132 of your book, he talks about some of the criticisms that have been made of his viewpoint. And he says, quote, "They think, and some of them say, that it is a return to the old superstition of special creation, that science has nothing to do with first causes, whether in the form of spiritual or divine agencies, and that once we begin to call in the aid of such non-natural and altogether hypothetical powers, we may as well give up science altogether," unquote. Does that not sound like the exact kind of criticism that modern intelligent design proponents face? They're compared to proponents of special creation. They're told that they're stopping scientific investigation and that we might as well just give up the scientific search for truth altogether. I mean, the same bogus criticisms were used to shut down discussion over Alfred Russel Wallace's ideas back in the early 1900s as is being done today, 100 years later. The materialists just don't give up the same old rhetoric, do they?
No, it's the same old story, and it's surprising how little things change.
I mean, I found this absolutely striking. So I think for our listeners, if there's anything that you can take from these podcasts, it's that Alfred Russel Wallace, he's not just an interesting historical figure, but given that he was a co-discoverer of the idea of natural selection, he was a huge proponent of the natural selection. He understood that natural selection had limits, or what we might call today the edge of evolution, and he felt that there were times when it was appropriate to invoke an intelligent cause. Now, you would make it very clear, Michael, that Alfred Russel Wallace's views certainly are not identical to modern intelligent design, and I think we'll get into that in just a couple minutes here, but the bottom line is that he was a proponent of intelligent design type thinking, and he was certainly not a standard creationist. And is that one of the most important facts about Alfred Russel Wallace, I guess, that you would say?
I think for us today, as we look at the ongoing debate, it's important to understand this old phrase, this old, tired, by now hackneyed phrase of evolution versus creationism is simply false. It's unhistorical, it's inaccurate, and it doesn't lend anything to the discussion other than to conflate the issues and confuse the essential points that need to be made in the discussion. I mean, if we're going to have a reasonable discussion about these issues, let's at least understand what we're talking about. And every time I hear somebody talking about evolution versus creationism, I know from the jump that they just don't get it.
Well, and it seems like reading Alfred Russel Wallace makes it very difficult to deny that the issue is far bigger than, say, evolution versus creationism, which is, I think, as you said, why so many evolutionists today try to really shove Wallace under the rug and just minimize the importance of him. So what is one of the main differences between Wallace's view of evolution and Darwin's view of evolution?
Well, this is a somewhat complex question. I don't know that I can answer it briefly for you. It's clear that Wallace developed a theory of common descent based upon natural selection that was strictly bounded by the principle of utility, which we'll get into later. But this strict bounding was all within a larger teleological and theistic framework. So for Wallace, natural selection, and in fact the phrase survival of the fittest, originally was coined by Herbert Spencer, but it was Alfred Russel Wallace who actually suggested that Darwin use it. At any rate, for Wallace, natural selection or survival of the fittest was a powerful explanatory principle in nature, but, and this is key, as you've already said, it couldn't explain everything. Now, the members of the Linnaean Society, here's what happened, to give you a little history on this. Wallace spent a good bit of time in the Malay Archipelago. While he was there, literally suffering from a malarial fever, in between bouts of fever, he wrote out his theory of natural selection. He did this, at least according to his own autobiography, on the island of Ternate. And he sent that letter to Darwin in 1858. This presented an immediate problem to Darwin. He gets this letter, and there it is, lo and behold, what he perceives to be largely his theory of natural selection, here all written out by some guy in the Malay Archipelago. Well, he consults with his friends, Charles Lyell, Joseph Hooker, who were members of the scientific elite of London at the time, and they decide the best approach to this is to present Wallace's paper as a joint paper along with Darwin's draft at a meeting of the Linnaean Society, one of the most prestigious scientific societies at the time. So they present this in July of 1858. The members of the Linnaean Society who heard Wallace's Ternate letter, along with Darwin's draft paper on his evolutionary theory, really saw no real difference. But there really were some major differences from the start. For one thing, Wallace never used the term selection in his original formulation. For another, and actually more importantly, Wallace rejected Darwin's use of domesticated animal breeding as a proof for the operations of natural selection. Now, both argued that their theories were principles based upon a constantly changing environment, along with very small variations that affected individual survival in response to environmental pressures, resulting in differential death rates, and moreover, that species held a tendency to form new perpetuating varieties. These resulted in adaptive progress for surviving species, while at the same time causing a branching indefinite divergence of new species. However, Darwin and Wallace both read Thomas Malthus differently, and Malthus was an important 18th century writer. Well, it came out in a number of editions also in the early 19th century, in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, on population, and they both read Malthus differently. Darwin considered the food supply had to be, on average, constant with the increase of population geometric. Wallace, on the other hand, saw the growth or depletion of a population due to available food and the ability of a given species to exploit it. So in other words, Darwin saw competition as taking place between individuals, while Wallace saw competition as taking place between populations. Competition led to modifications of a group under Darwin's view, with competition leading to changes in population size of several groups for Wallace. So Darwin focused on individual struggles for existence, while Wallace concentrated on population growth as a powerful modifying force in nature. Wallace saw evolution as taking place not in an individual, but in a demographic context. Both views had problems. Wallace failed to clearly distinguish varieties and variations. Darwin's hypothesis was premised upon the inheritance of acquired characteristics, a notion that was exploded years later, curiously enough, by August Weismann's attempt to disprove the phenomenon and the experimental removal of successive generations of rat tails. Wallace, who is the founder of biogeography, which is the study of biodiversity over time and space, in other words, why certain creatures live when and where they do. Wallace knew that domestic animals had a tendency to revert to their original stock if placed in a wild environment, or else they would perish. This would not work in reverse, however. In other words, wild species variation cannot be deduced from domestic practices because the very state of selection and then of subsequent feeding and protecting the newly bred animals effectively shelters them from the effects naturally bearing upon their survival. Wallace came to profoundly disagree with Darwin over his breeding examples, and as a proof of natural selection, he said that all they actually wound up demonstrating was unnatural selection. Wallace again emphasized the principle of utility, which was basically that no organ or attribute can exist in a natural species unless it's been useful to the organisms that possess it. Wallace always insisted that domestication introduced an artificial effect, and once this human intervention is removed, species either revert to their original type or they become extinct. Now, Darwin disagreed. He said domestication examples prove that heredity modification was possible and that artificial selection shows that small variations can accumulate to change the species type. Now, Darwin always believed that a general theory of selection was possible. Wallace always believed that Darwin's example of domestic breeders was naively anthropomorphic. Darwin even went so far to claim at one point that the line between unconscious selection and natural selection was difficult to discern. And of course, Darwin never did explain exactly how and when microvariation would produce macrospeciation and still leave his chance and random modification theory inviolate, which was his central thesis. By comparison, Wallace's application of the principle of utility is, if nothing else, more consistent with the principle itself. And either case, common descent, along with its requisite macroevolutionary change, remains a given. So they had very different views as to how evolution actually would work out. Wallace came to realize something that molecular biologist Michael Behe would note over 100 years later, and that is that common descent is true, but the explanation of common descent, even though it may be fascinating, is in some profound senses really rather trivial. It says merely that commonalities were there from the start, but it doesn't really explain where those commonalities came from or how humans subsequently acquired remarkable differences. For Behe, and I think for Wallace as well, something that is non-random has to account for the common descent of life. And when you look at Darwin's theory and you look at Wallace's theory, those are profound and fundamental differences.
You talk a lot in your book about Alfred Russel Wallace's principle of utility, and you talked about that a little bit. Could you elaborate on the meaning of utility and exactly how he applies it? And what do you mean when you talk about utility and how that's a challenge to natural selection?
The principle is the idea that no organ or attribute can exist in a species in nature unless it's been useful to the organism that possesses it. Now, Wallace applies it in a variety of contexts. The two best examples are the bird's feather and the phenomenon of pain. Wallace talks extensively about the bird's feather and its intricate apparatus, that without the feather, the bird would die, so it absolutely does need it as a principle of utility. On the other hand, the feather itself is designed. You can think about the flagellar motor that Michael Behe uses as an example. Clearly, the bacterial flagellum serves a utilitarian purpose for the bacteria that possess it. They allow it to be mobile, to move around. Without the flagellum, they would literally be dead in the water. On the other hand, if you look at that apparatus, it has all the evidence of being designed. It's, in effect, a structured mechanism. So Wallace talks about the feather in very much the same light. Now, what's more interesting, I think, is his application of this principle to the problem of pain. He has a whole chapter on this in his World of Life, and he points out that Darwin and many of the other disciples of Darwin, Thomas Huxley and so on, really don't very effectively deal with this problem, nor, in his opinion, did they see it correctly. Using his own words, none of them saw, in Wallace's own words, the very existence of pain as being one of the essential factors in evolution, as having been developed in the animal world for a purpose, as being strictly subordinated to the law of utility, and therefore never developed beyond what was actually needed for the preservation of life. It is from this point of view that he goes on then to discuss the question, and what he actually winds up saying is that pain, the degree of pain and the extent of pain, is never given in a greater degree than that which is requisite to the animal that possesses it. So, for example, lower animals, for him, probably don't feel any pain. I mean, insects, for example, he would postulate don't. As we go up the natural chain of existence on up to man can feel extensive pain, and man can even feel pain beyond, you know, sort of physical pain, the pain of the loss of a loved one, grief, and so on. But these comport to the necessities requisite to the individual. In man, because many of humankind properties have gone beyond the mere level of utility, we find pain to some extent in the same context, thereby enlarged. But even in mankind, Wallace always viewed it as having purpose. One of the things that supposedly led to Darwin's abandonment of theistic belief was, there's this famous quote from him where, you know, he couldn't bear to see a cat play with a mouse and these kind of sort of simplistic ideas. He saw so much pain in nature, he couldn't have imagined that God would have created a world with pain. Wallace answers that by saying, well, you know, pain serves a purpose. Pain is necessary for the protection of the animal and actually for the betterment of the human individual. And rather than just writing it off as something inexplicable and therefore there is no God, Wallace actually flips that, in a sense, on Darwin's rather weak reasoning and says, not really, because because if you look at pain properly, at least in the lower animals, certainly through the principle of utility and for the betterment of humankind, pain does not become an insurmountable difficulty.
Well, Mr. Flannery, I want to maybe ask one more question in this podcast, and we'll move on and talk some more about Wallace in the next one. But how did the class differences between Darwin and Wallace affect their ideas?
Well, I think they did, and I think they did in two ways. To get some sense of this, we have to understand that Wallace and Darwin were from very different walks of life. Wallace wasn't poor, but he was definitely from the struggling middle class. Money was always an issue for him. And for Darwin, he came from the privileged class. He attended the best universities. He attended the University of Edinburgh and Cambridge, and Wallace put himself through the Mechanics Institute of London, just by its very name, a much more modest working man's institution. Darwin got the benefit of the instruction of some of the best scholars in England, while Wallace wound up teaching himself botany and biology with some inexpensive field guides. But that said, they had very different field experiences. Darwin had 5 years experience, of course, on the Beagle, the excursion from 1831 to 1836. Wallace, on the other hand, had more than twice Darwin's field experience. He spent from 1848 to 1852 in the Amazon, and from 1854 to 1862, he was in the East, mostly in the Malay Archipelago. So for Wallace, he racked up 12 years of field experience to Darwin's 5. And the way this, I think, impacted Wallace is he tended to have a less elitist view of people. Nowhere did this come out more clearly than in his attitude toward the growing interest in eugenics. They had always had very different views about how to demonstrate the operation of evolution. While Darwin often used domestic breeding examples in animals, Wallace never thought that that was an appropriate example. He always referred to that as artificial selection and always thought that Darwin was just wrong in using that. Nonetheless, if Wallace thought that Darwin's examples of domestic breeding in animals were inappropriate to natural selection, he certainly thought they were doubly so when the breeding examples became human. Wallace believed in a free and open marriage and social reform, not human engineering, would answer the question of progress for Wallace, and he insisted that women should have a free choice in marriage and referred to eugenics as a mere excuse for establishing a medical tyranny. And he quite loudly said, "We have enough of this kind of tyranny already. The world doesn't want the eugenicists to set it straight. Eugenics is simply the medical and interference of an arrogant scientific priestcraft." So he was a man who was very sensitive to the manipulations of the elite toward those who were less empowered. The flip side, of course, was that Darwin was part and parcel of the elite. It's not surprising that his cousin, Francis Galton, coined the term eugenics and vocally promoted it. So to get to the differences then, that how that really made a difference, is that from the very beginning, when Wallace began to split from Darwin's thinking, it's quite clear that Darwin really remained cordial but distant from Wallace and some of his ideas. Why did Wallace not accept the obvious, namely that his theory really was dramatically different from Darwin's? It's hard to say, but I think there's two reasons. First is the social structure of Victorian England was very class conscious. One always knew where one stood when it came to the social ladder of society, and if one didn't, they were reminded of it very quickly. It was, by its very nature, society ruled by a deferential pecking order, and I think Wallace was keenly aware of that. But second of all, Wallace probably also hearkened back to his own memory on that day in July of 1858 when his Ternate letter was read before the Linnaean Society. And this really occurred only because Darwin, Charles Lyell, and Joseph Hooker let it happen. It was their solution to the fact of Wallace's independent discovery of natural selection, and by presenting his paper at the Linnaean Society, they could present it in such a way as to allow Darwin's priority to show forth really with unquestionable prominence. Janet Brown admits that even Darwin winced when he saw the order of the program, but nevertheless, for Wallace, this was a real opportunity, and Wallace got immediate access to the scientific elite of London in ways that he really couldn't have in any other way. So I think throughout the course of their respective careers, as Wallace would increasingly veer away from Darwin's ideas about evolution. They remain a product of class difference. He never acknowledged a distinction of Wallaceism, as it was sometimes referred to in his own lifetime, but insisted he merely applied Darwin's own principles to his own conclusions of what evolution meant. Of course, the more carefully you look at that, you find that that's in fact not the case. But I think his reluctance to do that was a product of this class deference and the great privilege he had in having that original paper read before the Linnaean Society.
Well, thank you so much, Michael Flannery, author of Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism, published by Erasmus Press. The website is erasmuspress.net, and we're going to have more with Michael Flannery talking about his book in part three of this podcast. So thank you so much, Michael Flannery, for being on the show with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Stay tuned for more with Michael Flannery talking about Alfred Russel Wallace. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.